Warren et al., Allison Rivers, Warren Rivers, Harvey, Harvey, we have two.
Good morning. I'm Steve Emmert, and along with George Peterson, I represent the co-trustees of a family trust in this appeal that involves a contract to make a will. It is usually my preference in preparing for arguments to be able to identify issues of first impression that you'd be able to address in the case. I confess that I cannot do so in this case. This is a matter of pure error correction. But error there was. In this case below, the trial court overrode a will based upon a promise, so such as it claimed, that was unsupported by testimony or documentation. Before I move to the merits, there's one point I want to mention because I think it's important for your understanding of it. The ostensible arrangement that was claimed between the testator and his wife were that if the plaintiffs would wait until after their stepfather died, they would get more. That's the language that they stated in the testimony that we've identified in the briefs. It was not that they would get one-third of the testator's estate. That's something that they expressly disavowed in the statement on page 62 of the appendix. So we know that wasn't what was in the evidence in the record. It's worth noting, however, that they got what they claimed they were supposed to get, which is more. You'll note from pages, only five pages in the record of the appendix, pages 67 through 71, there was testimony about what their mother's estate was. She owned very little on her own. She owned some jewelry. She owned a piano. And she owned two lots in West Virginia. And you'll see from the record that they got all of those. Indeed, the lots were sold before Mrs. Dean passed away, and the money was kept by one of the plaintiffs. So they got, in this case, a bequest from the testator of $200,000 on top of that. Now, that was substantially more than what their mother could possibly have left them. In order to substantiate their claim for millions in this case, they had to come up with a different promise. They had to come up with one that was found nowhere in the evidence to give them one-third of everything that the testator owned. That's exactly what they claimed, and that's what the trial court found in this case. It's understandable that a testator in this position would naturally favor what I think the term is the heirs of his body, learned that term from Professor Neil Alford back in law school, when he's making the bequest and favoring them with the bulk of his estate, while still leaving a six-figure bequest to his stepchildren. And that's what he did in his trust documents. But despite the absence of any evidence of proof of a contrary promise, the trial court found one, even in the face of a clear and convincing mountain.
Mr. Emmert, what do you make of the conversation between the daughter and the mother, where the mother does mention the one-third widow's portion, and then almost contemporaneously with the conversation that the mother discusses with the daughter, the stepfather goes to his attorney and drafts a trust that would indicate one-third to his wife's children and two-thirds to his children?
There are probably two or three aspects to that answer, and I'll address them in order. The first is that the highest that the plaintiff's testimony reached in that was that, and I think I can quote it exactly, she mentioned something about the widow's third, but I don't know more than that. So in terms of a clear and convincing standard, I think I can safely say, standing at this lectern, that falls far short of it. The second component of it is making a contemporaneous trust document. There were two trust documents that are relevant here. One is a revocable trust into which three parts of real estate were placed, and that's the only thing it was ever funded with. The second was an irrevocable trust that was never funded, and under clear Virginia law, that is no trust at all. So when you have to prove something by clear and convincing evidence, to simply say she mentioned something about the widow's third, but I don't know more than that, and the creation of a trust that is clearly revocable in nature doesn't meet the standard that's required and that you have always required in the contract to make will cases.
Counsel, I think the judge's soliloquy is fascinating because essentially she indicates that if you look at any one of these pieces of evidence in a vacuum, none of them are satisfactory in a vacuum. But when you piece them all together over time, the first conversation with the daughter, the second conversation that the daughter had with the defendant in this action, the fact that two different professionals created trusts, and then in both instances he said, no, no, that's not what I want. And then he went and did it himself the first time, and the second time he instructed one of the best trust and estates attorneys in Virginia, do it differently than you're recommending, because that's how I want it. She indicated that when you put all of that evidence in a line, it becomes clear and convincing. Now, first of all, if you would respond to that. Second of all, what deference do we give to that trial judge's findings of fact that led to her ultimate ruling?
All right, I'll address the first question, which is to say that if you add together all of those circumstances, they don't get you to even the standard that this court rejected in the Keith versus Luloff's case, which is cited by the plaintiffs in their brief. In that case, there were affirmatively reciprocal wills made. They went to that extent, which did not happen here. There was no reciprocal will made by Mrs. Dean in favor of Mr. Dean's children. And in this situation, you have the timing, and that's the only thing the trial judge had to rule upon, because there wasn't any evidence admitted for the sake of for the truth of the matter asserted in this case that indicated that the testator actually made such a promise. It was their understanding that he had done so. But that evidence was not admitted for the truth of the matter asserted.
Didn't the court overrule the hearsay objection?
Your Honor, the court agreed in, there were two separate objections. In one, it was expressly admitted only to prove the substance of the conversation, but not for the truth of the matter asserted. That's specifically the trial judge's ruling. In the second, the evidence was offered, an objection was made, and the plaintiff's lawyer said, we're offering it for the to prove state of mind. And the judge said, well, we all know you really want it for the truth of the matter asserted, but I'm going to overrule the objection and I'm going to let it in.
Right. The court said, we know you're admitting it for hearsay, I'm overruling the objection.
In order to prove the state of mind of the person making the statement.
Well, hearsay and state of mind are two separate objections.
Well.
And she said, I'm overruling, we know you want it for the truth of the matter asserted. We know you want it for the hearsay. I'm overruling the objection.
Right. But the state of the mind is an objection, an exception to the hearsay rule. It's not a completely separate
but
issue.
But the trial lawyer's objection was to hearsay, was it not?
Correct.
And the court said, I'm overruling your objection.
Right, because of the response that the plaintiffs gave, which is, we're offering it to prove state of mind, which is an exception to the hearsay rule. I think the only way fairly to read those comments by the judge is, I understand what you want, but I'm going to let it in anyway, despite the fact that it's only for
now. Knowing that this is a bench trial and not a jury trial, is the judge, are you arguing that the judge is not permitted to consider it for the truth under these circumstances, based upon her response?
I think that's correct, because the only purpose for which it was offered was to prove state of mind. They expressly disavowed any intention to get it in for the truth of the matter asserted.
But that's not my question. My question is the judge, despite whatever their intent was, is she not permitted to consider it for the truth once it's in?
I do believe that. Yes, Your Honor. In this instance,
to make that answer clear, you do believe that it is not permissive. You may not use it for the truth of the matter stated.
I believe that is correct.
Right. Yes, I just want to make sure that answer was clear.
Yes. In this case, I think that in order for the truth, clear and convincing standard to still have any teeth, we have to have more than speculation. We have to have more than wishful thinking. We have to have more than hopefulness. In this case, we have none of that beyond anything beyond a wish for the plaintiff.
The second part of Justice Mims' question, which I would like for you to answer, is what standard do we apply to the trial court's finding?
In terms of findings of fact, I think you have to afford the same deference that you do to a jury trial. I'll readily acknowledge that. The legal rulings, of course, are a different matter, and I think we all know those are reviewed to know that. May I leave to respond in the time of
but if the finding of fact is based upon evidence that should not have been admitted, that's error.
Exactly.
All right.
That's good.
Counsel, if I may.
I cannot get away from
you. Did you assign error to her does your assignment of error permit you to reach the issue of her improperly considering evidence for the truth once she had admitted it for a proper purpose? I don't see that within the assignment of error.
We assigned two errors at the petition stage. The court granted one. I took that as a meaning that the court understood that it was admitted only for the truth of the matter asserted. I'm not sure that the court has ever stated that it admitted for the truth of the matter asserted, because her soliloquy, as you described it, doesn't say, I find that this statement was made by the testator to his wife.
But having only accepted one assignment of error, is it your argument that the court can then look behind her admission of the evidence to determine whether or not it could be considered for the truth as well as for the state of mind?
I'm not going to ask the court to expand the assignments of error. I know better than that. But what I think that we're proceeding on is the trial judge admitted it. We're going to assume that the trial judge admitted it for a proper purpose, because judges are presumed to get these things right.
And well, what this does is that it just recognizes what lawyers do all over the Commonwealth. I want this admitted for the state of mind. And the trial judge has been a trial lawyer. He says, well, we all know why you really want it, but I will admit it for the truth of the matter stated. I mean, isn't that what happened?
That's not what the judge said. She just said, I'll overrule the objection. I think that what she was doing was admitting it for the purpose that the plaintiffs expressly offered, which is to prove state of mind, but not to prove the truth of the matter asserted. I think that we would have to assume the judge obeyed the law in that, the law of evidence.
So let me make sure that I understand the response that you gave earlier to Justice Lemons. If you're right that she admitted it only for state of mind and not for the truth of the matter asserted, then it's your position it would be improper for her to use it for the truth of the matter.
I believe it would be improper.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Philip Harvey, and I represent the daughters of Shirley Gregg Dean, who were the plaintiffs in the circuit court. It's Barbara Morris, Linda Gregg, and Joanne Sundell. The claim in the trial court was that Marion Caleb Dean, who we called Casey Sr. in the briefs, breached an agreement to leave these three women a third of his estate when he died. They were the daughters of his wife, who was his third wife. His prior two wives had both died. Under Virginia law, we accept that in order to establish the claim that was alleged and pleaded, the plaintiffs needed to establish by the terms of the contract and the existence of the contract by clear and convincing evidence, and the trial court found that they did just that after a trial on the merits. The trial court then awarded them $1.8 million, which was one-third of his liquid assets. They weren't awarded any part of the real estate, not because the court found that that was somehow outside the contract, but the trial court found there was a failure of proof as to the value of that real estate because the plaintiffs had only sued for monetary damage. The issue on appeal, I respectfully submit, is whether the decision of the trial court reached after a trial on the merits is plainly wrong or without evidence to support it. There was some sparring in the briefs over the standard on appeal, the standard of review. The appellant said in the briefs that this court must accept with caution and examine with scrutiny the evidence offered by the plaintiffs, and they offered that as the standard of review. That's not right. That quote is from a case, Blinko versus Blinko, which is actually quoting an earlier case, Patton versus Patton, from 1960, which said that's the task of the trial court when addressing a claim that has to be established by clear and convincing evidence, to look at the evidence with caution and examine it with scrutiny, as a good trial court should do and as this trial court did. Once she reached the conclusion, the trial court reached the conclusion, the standard is, as that Patton case says, whether or not it was clear error or plainly wrong or without evidence to support it. That's the standard of review from any clear and convincing case. It's the standard of review in any case involving testamentary documents, and as the Black versus Edwards case in 1994 makes clear, that's the standard that should be used here. You can't simply substitute your judgment for what the trial court did. The question is what she did plainly wrong or without any evidence to support it, and it's not.
Well, that doesn't preclude us from determining whether or not the evidence was sufficient.
That's correct. That's
and it also correct. Doesn't preclude us from determining that in the corpus of the evidence that she used to reach her conclusion that she considered matters that were not properly admitted in evidence.
That's right.
Well, I agree with your standard.
As to the issue of the evidence that was properly admitted, in the petition for appeal, there were two issues. One was the one the court accepted, whether the decision was plainly wrong without evidence to support it. The second was whether those statements were admitted improperly as hearsay for the truth of the matter asserted. That's what they brought to the court, and the court denied the writ as to that. So what the judge said when the question was asked, the objection was made, and the objection was hearsay. And the trial lawyer for the plaintiff said, well, we're just offering it for the truth, not for the truth of the matter asserted, but for state of mind of Shirley, the mother, not the daughter. And the judge, who's done this a couple of times before, said, well, I know, but you really want it for the truth of the matter asserted, with a bit of a smile. And she said, well, I'll overrule the objection. She did not say, I'll overrule the objection, but let it in only for state of mind.
But that's what it was offered for. I mean, can the judge, if a lawyer offers something for a particular purpose, can the judge say, and the other side objects, can the judge say, well, I'll let it in, and I'm going to look at it for other reasons, too, even though you didn't want me to?
Yes.
You think they can?
Yes. Judge can look at evidence, and the judge can conclude what evidence the judge needs to look at, and what the judge can conclude what evidence is proper for that judge to
So if a party says, I don't think it's true, and I don't want you to admit it for the truth of it, the judge can say, agree with you that I'm going to admit it for that purpose, but then look at it for whatever they want to.
Yes.
Okay. Counsel, I want to follow that question, and it might be an identical question, but it's an important issue here. In pages 225 and 226 of the joint appendix, it is apparent that the judge did consider the conversations for the truth of what was stated in the conversations.
Yes.
And your opposing counsel indicates that that would be improper, that that cannot be done. Do you have any case citations indicating that in a bench trial, when a judge admits the evidence solely for state of mind, the judge can subsequently presume the truth of that evidence in support of a ruling?
No, I do. There are no citations in the brief, and I don't have any to offer you here today.
But there is an analogy that is very important. Triers of fact are either juries or they're judges.
Yeah.
If that had been a jury deciding this matter, you would have been entitled to an instruction that you are not to consider it for the truth of the matter stated. Now, if the jury is going to get an instruction like that as a trier of fact, why does a judge get a pass on what is clearly the declination between state of mind and truth of the matter stated? And the answer is they don't. The judge cannot deal with it for a reason that a jury couldn't deal with it.
Right, except this judge in this case, I respectfully submit, based on the record, admitted it for the truth of the matter asserted. She did not limit it in any way.
Well, I'm not sure the record supports you on that point, but you can continue with your argument. It was offered for state of mind, and it's clear to me that it was actually received and used by the trial judge for the truth of the matter stated. And in a similar situation, if it had been a jury that was the trier of fact, they would have been instructed that they cannot do so. And if they cannot do so as a trier of fact, neither can the judge.
Right, unless the judge admits it for the truth of the matter asserted, then she doesn't need to give that instruction.
Well, that, you are correct about that.
Yes.
But I'm not sure that I agree with you that the record supports that, because the only thing the trial lawyer asked for it to be considered for was state of mind.
Right. That is true. And then the judge, I think the court is entitled to say, okay, well, I'm going to let it in for more than you want it because I think it's admissible. Now, she didn't say it that way. She just said, I overruled the objection.
Now, I think what happens here is what happens in courtrooms all over the Commonwealth, probably all over America, and it usually happens in a jury trial. And the lawyer wants to get something in for state of mind because they know the jury's going to hear it and they're going to deal with it for the truth of the matter stated. So you get an instruction and you hope the jury will actually follow it. Here you have a bench trial and some idea that a bench trial makes a difference. It doesn't make any difference. They're both triers of fact.
Right.
And they're subject to the same rules.
Yes.
Counsel?
Yes.
Would it have been proper if the argument, hypothetically, if the trial attorney had said, "Judge, I want it admitted for the truth," it would not have been proper for the judge to allow it in for the truth, would it? The judge would have properly had to deny that that request.
Well, unless the judge concludes that it should be admitted under the catch-all to the hearsay exceptions, I think it's Rule 2803-24-26, I think the judge has discretion to admit evidence if she finds it credible. But it's also important to realize that when the judge made her decision, she said that that statement by Shirley, or by Barbara, from Shirley's statement to Barbara, the mother's statement to the daughter, only gets us so far. She didn't find that that was a conclusive be-all and end-all of this case. She didn't say, therefore, since...
I don't think anybody claims that.
Right. It's admitted, and it's a guidepost. Even if it's just admitted as to state of mind, it shows the state of mind of Shirley, that as far as Shirley is concerned, she has a contract with her husband.
Let me ask you this. What was Shirley's consideration for the contract that you claim that she had with her husband?
Shirley's consideration?
Yeah.
The consideration really is from her daughters that it's a three-party contract. And it's the daughters who would forego taking under Shirley's will, and if they did that, then Casey had agreed to give them one-third of his estate.
So Shirley didn't provide any consideration?
I don't think so, no. We didn't. That wasn't the way the case was pleaded. It was the daughters who provided the consideration.
But the contract was with Shirley.
Well, the contract is really of the three of them, yes. And so the consideration is provided by the daughters to not take under Casey's will.
So that wouldn't have happened until years later?
So
there was no agreement when Shirley passed away, sounds like you're telling me.
No, there was an agreement. It just wasn't effective yet. I mean,
it wasn't
agreement.
A contract.
There is a contract.
But it had not been... There can't be a contract until there's consideration given, and you're saying that the consideration was the daughter's foregoing taken under their mother's will, which they could not do until their mother died.
Then if you go back, it's the daughter's promise not to take under the will that they make at the time, that they're going to not take under the will. They say they won't take under the will, and then when Casey dies, they don't take, and when their mother dies, they don't take under the will. So whether it's a promise or the action, that's still the consideration. And that, frankly, wasn't an issue that was raised at trial. But that's how it turns out. And then what the judge did was she starts with the statement that there is a state of mind that Shirley thinks she has a contract. And then she goes through the rest of it. And she finds, okay, well, that only gets you so far. You've got to prove the terms. What are the terms? And so she looks at the contemporaneous record.
Can I stop you for a second? So my understanding of where you are in your analysis is that, you know, Shirley thinks that if her daughters forego taking under the will, their stepfather will give them more than they would get if they took under her will. Is that where we are in the analysis?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
And her estate is as Mr. Emmerich represented, the mother's will, the mother's estate.
The mother's estate, there was precious little evidence as to what it is that would have been under the estate. There was some evidence as to some minor things she had. Mr. Emmerich's argument, though, was... It's interesting. It's, well, there was a contract and he fulfilled it. I mean, that argument is, if you don't take under your mother's will, when I die, you'll get more. And so his argument is, well, that happened, which means that's a concession, sort of, that there is a contract.
Maybe it's assuming arguendo. I mean, it wasn't. I assumed he was like, assuming for the sake of argument there was an agreement, they still got everything they were supposed to get, I think is what he was
saying. Right.
He's not saying there was. He's saying if there was.
Okay. But then you go on to the next step, which is what is the agreement, and that's when the judge looked at the trusts that Casey Sr. prepared contemporaneously with Shirley's conversation with her daughter and contemporaneously with Shirley about to have the operation that Casey Sr.'s prior wife died and she had. And so he
but one of those trusts would have just been with regard to three pieces of property, right? It would not have been the entire estate. Am I right about that?
The second one. The first one not. But the point not is not what the trust ultimately ends up in, what ultimately ends up in the trust. The point is, because nothing does, that's why there's a breach of contract. The point is that it shows the two-thirds, one-third.
What?
Of everything. That's what the judge found.
I know what the judge found, but where's the evidence that it was of everything? Well, could be a third of personal property, a third of investments, a third of real estate.
If those trusts had been funded as they were, as read on their terms, everything would have gone into them. Now, they weren't funded.
No, the second trust only had three pieces of property in it.
So doesn't that show an intent not to have the whole estate?
No, because the first trust was going to have everything else.
Well, how do you know when there's no funding
in it? That's what the trust says. That's what the trust says he was going to do. He was going to put all of his assets in that trust. Well, he didn't do it.
Well, why do we believe that's the promise when it was the second trust that was actually executed? That revocable trust that he executed with three pieces of property in it. Mom was still alive. She knew what was there. Why wouldn't we assume that if there was an agreement, that was what the agreement was? For my daughter's foregoing their take under my will, they're going to get a third of a trust with three pieces of property in it.
He executed two trusts.
And he funded one.
Right, and he funded one.
And it had three pieces of property in it.
And it had three pieces of property.
So at the end of the day, aren't those two pieces of evidence conflicting?
No. No, because whenever somebody breaches the contract, they don't do what they promise. He creates the vehicle to fulfill the promise. He creates the trust, which, if funded, would fulfill the promise he made.
How do we know which one of those trusts is the right one?
They both are.
Well, counsel, there's no finding of fact with regard to that. Let me, for purposes of argument, he tries to create a trust, goes to his nephew, I believe, to do so.
Right.
And nephew says, yeah, I'm not going to do what you want. And he goes, okay, I'll do it myself. And he goes and gets a form. And he's a man of considerable wealth. And so after he's done that, for whatever reason, he says, you know, I need to have some estate advice. I need to plan my estate. And he goes to, as I've mentioned before, one of the best trust and estates attorneys in the entire state. It strains credulity that he would go to Frank Thomas and say, give me an estate plan, and yet leave in place with the intent of it being active a form that he prepared himself. Respond to that, if you would.
Yes. First of all, there isn't any evidence in the record as to communications he had with Mr. Thomas that yielded the second trust. Mr. Thomas does a lot of these. And so he couldn't, what you just posited, he went to Mr. Thomas and said, I need estate planning, please do it.
I think that's in your pleas.
He went to Mr. Thomas
for estate plan.
He went to Mr. Thomas, and Mr. Thomas did the trust. It's not clear, there is nothing in the record as to whether Mr. Thomas knew about those prior trusts and how, whether he meant to modify them. But the point is, it doesn't strain credulity, because what happens is, after Mr. Thomas does the trust, Mr. Dean says, well, we don't know what Mr. Dean said. What we know is the result, which is the trust is undone and redone to go back to the two-thirds, one-third, because Mr. Thomas had everything left with the children. And that's what we know. And that's consistent with what the judge said, trying to, as somebody said, get all the evidence added up in a line and conclude, based on all of the totality of the circumstances, that they proved by, we proved by clear and convincing evidence that there was such a contract. I see my time is up. I ask that the court affirm the trial.
I want to tie up a few loose ends here before I have some closing comments. First, with regard to Mr. Harvey's opening comment about the standard of review in Blinko, he has misstated which court is the one that should be applying that standard. At 209 Virginia at 244, this court said, we must accept with caution and examine with scrutiny the evidence proffered. That's clearly talking about a standard of review, not a trial court standard. Mr. Justice Mims's question relating to pages 225 and 226 of the appendix inferred the trial judge had admitted this for the truth of the matter asserted, but at 224 you can see that what the judge is reciting is not what the plaintiffs had proved, but what the plaintiffs had to prove. She's reciting what their burden is in the last four lines of page 224. So I don't think it's fair to say in that, but the judge had indeed admitted this. In this case, I will preach to the choir, if you'll permit me to do so. Trial courts aren't allowed to revise testators' wishes as to what to do with their own bounty. I don't have to urge that too strongly because you've said it so very many times. In this case, we had a decedent who had expressed wishes as to how he wanted to handle his estate. If this were a novel concept, then I would have an issue of first impression from you, but your jurisprudence is far too well established. Courts have to stay out of these decisions unless there's clear and convincing evidence to the contrary. Not a suspicion, not hopefulness, not wishes on the part of heirs who were overlooked or, in their perception, overlooked. And indeed, I was speaking arguendo, assuming that there had been a contract. They did get more than what they were claiming that they should have received. But in this case, there was no proof, using the standard that we have to overcome a will. And that's why this case has to be reversed. Thank you for your interest in the issues of this case and for your courtesy to me today.
The court will take a short recess.